Good afternoon and welcome to another Saturday on Woods and Water, South Carolina. It is indeed a great day in South Carolina. You hear that when you call a government office. But hey, any day you can wake up in this state, it's a good one. You know, Kevin Cohen down in Columbia, you can listen to us now at 100.7 in Columbia in the Midlands. He asked me, he said, you know, when you go on the show every Saturday for a few weeks, let everybody know what this show is about. So it's just like the name says, Woods and Water. It's about the outdoors. It's about getting you out there, giving you the information you needed to go, where to go, what to do, and how to do it. And sometimes these shows are way more cool than other shows. And today is one of those because today we have a very special guest for 16 years. Over 16 years now, he's been the host of Jim Shockey's Hunting Adventures. For over 6 years, he's been the host of Jim Shockey's Uncharted, both of which you can see on the Outdoor Channel. He's been on the show once before with his daughter, Eva, and it turned into a Boys Against the Girls, and I think the girls won, Jim.
Well, they have the advantage because they can play dirty. We have to play by the Marcus of Queensbury rule.
That's exactly right. So after we had Jim and Eva on with Taylor and I last time, I said, you know, I really want to get Jim on, and I do appreciate taking time to be here. I know this is show season. I know you weren't at ATA. You were at Dallas Safari Club, and I imagine you're getting ready to head to SHOT Show, aren't you?
That's exactly what I'm doing right now, preparing. I think I have 4 days here on Vancouver Island, and then I'll be catching the flight down to Vegas.
Wow. I think I'm going to go to SHOT next year. I think I'm going to go. I've toyed with it for a few years now. I went to it one time years ago when it was in Atlanta and the World Commerce Center, which was really small. I understand the sands is maybe three stories.
Hey, it is amazing how big that show is. And you know, the shooting sports, it shows how healthy the shooting sports are. And, of course, we've got the professional side as well, the military there now.
Right.
And it's a spectacle. It's worth going to. There, just about everybody you can imagine that's remotely associated with hunting, shooting the outdoors, they'll be there.
Wow. Well, I think I was on the plane when I left ATA coming home. I was on the plane with a friend of mine, Karen Lutto from Hunter Outdoor Communications, and we were talking about SHOT because I'd never been, and I think she convinced me to go.
Yeah,
so
that's
maybe next year.
I would highly recommend it. I mean, it's not a consumer show. It's an industry show.
Right.
So unfortunately, you know, you can't come in off the street. But as a communicator, you'd absolutely get a press pass.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. I'm a member of the outdoor media, and they welcome us. Although they limit us there. I think 1,600, which is 1,600. That's a lot of media guys. Wow.
Well, I didn't realize that. I mean, back in the old days, it was like me and Zumbo and Weishun and Judd Cooney, and that was about it. You know, Ron Spomer was in there, and a few of the other guys, Wayne Van Zoll. But it's definitely a lot bigger nowadays.
Yeah, that's what I asked her how long I needed to take, and she said you probably need 3, probably 4 days to do it right.
I think it's over 7 miles if you walk the aisles and don't slow down. So, I mean, if you can, and you're not going to be able to not slow down because there's so many people packing the aisles. So it would take 4 days for sure to see everything.
Wow. Well, that's on the calendar for next year. 2021. Got that, Angelo? Okay.
Perfect.
Well, like I said, you know, you've been for over 30 years now, you have been an outfitter in the Yukon Territory with Uncharted. You have gone to some places that are just really bizarre. from a guy who hunts from South Carolina, you've been to some really cool places. But before we get into all that, last time you were on, you had a granddaughter, Lenny, who called you Big Baba. And now you're up to 4. So Brandon has 2, Eva has 2. What kind of changes does that bring to your life?
Well, I mean, for one, my wife, Nana Wheezy, of 35 years, I don't think she knows my name anymore. So that's the biggest change. Me and my dog, Rez, are kind of, you know,
outcasts.
Persona non grata around our places. and seriously, if I was to do it all over again, I'd have the grandchildren first, because this is when Nana Wheezy could care less if I go hunting for 360 days a year. You know, go ahead, whatever.
Whatever.
You
know, I have grandkids.
You have a moose waiting for you, so that's the biggest change.
But I'm sure I can only imagine grandkids. My oldest daughter just got married in May, and I'm thinking grandkids. But you got four of them. That is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, we have three boy, you know, grandsons, and Lenny Bo, of course, who was the first one of all,
right,
and still is definitely the princess of the crowd. It's amazing. I mean, that's really why we're here on this planet. When you break it right down to its essence, to see, you know, these children that, you know, have our genes and obviously mixed up with the other side grandparents' genes and you know, our son and daughter. I mean, it's just, it really puts perspective of the wonder of this incredible planet we live on. And, you know, the daily, you know, whatever trials and tribulations we're all facing, they kind of become not that important. You know, the important thing is these little new beings that are coming into this world and the joy that they bring. I mean, when they laugh, smile, do anything cute, which is pretty much constantly, it puts how amazing this planet really is and this one life we're given, you know, how important it is to the family part of it. So it's changed. It's made me wiser and of course humbler.
Absolutely. Well, we got about 3 minutes here for the first break. And I don't want to get anything too deep because we got some deep stuff to talk about. But in reading one of the articles about you and all, there was something brought up about a bandana. And just for the fun of it, tell us about the bandana. How'd you come to be wearing the bandana on all your TV shows?
You know, that was a fellow named Richard P. Smith. And by the way, before I go there, I was just thinking to myself, I just said that I'm wiser and humbler, which is, if you're wiser, you don't say you're humbler. So I was going, oh, man, what a dummy. But anyway, Richard P. Smith was an outdoor writer for Outdoor Life, and I guided him on Vancouver Island. And he, you know, he's a professional. I'm not sure where Richard is nowadays, but he, you know, he was writing for the biggest magazines. And he told me that when you take photographs, you want to have some color in the photograph. And I don't know what the reason is for composition. So that's when I said, well, a bandana would be, you know, colorful in a photograph. So it actually started like that. It wasn't so much a fashion statement or practicality. It was more to make the photos, any of the hero shots, whatever photos I was in, to make them pop a little bit.
Okay.
And then I quickly found out that bandana is super handy. I mean, if it's hot weather, you wrap it around your head, keeps the sweat out of your eyes, and for me, it keeps my hair from blowing in my eyes, which is a pain in the rear end on a windy day. And then, you know, it keeps your neck warm. A lot of people don't realize how much heat you lose through your wrists and your ankles and your neck. So it actually keeps my neck warm. It's got a practical purpose as well. And then now it's kind of turned into a brand. My newest ones, I just got a whole big box full of them. They've got Hornady logo all over them.
Wow.
So that's kind of cool. I'm excited about starting to wear those.
Absolutely. Hornady being one of the sponsors of your show.
That's correct. Yeah, that's a new sponsor. I've known Steve Hornady and Jason Hornady for forever. I mean, they're a great company. You know, there's many, many great companies.
Sure.
That in our industry, it really is truly the greatest industry to be involved with. And you know, there's a lot of good companies. Jason and Steve, I've wanted to work with them for, you know, a long time. And I finally got the opportunity. So they're a new sponsor of our television show.
Very cool. Well, let's wrap up the first segment of this show with a little gem that you don't hear a whole lot. Hang on through, and we'll be back with more Woods and Water on the other side.
My word is good, I'll tell your son. Invade my home and you'll meet my gun. Bang, bang. Bang, 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 bang. Bang, bang. Bang, 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 bang. I'm kind of like the man in the moon. Have a dark side and two faces.
Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. It's not often my guests provide their own bumper music. But Jim Shockey has, when he comes on this show, he has his own bumper music. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. You know, we kind of, first segment was kind of a little introduction, just having some fun and all. And, but Jim, I mean, you have been around the hunting industry for, I mean, you're an icon. I mean, I saw you up on the stage at Dallas Safari Club with guys that I would say are other icons right along with you. So you've been there, you've seen a lot. Tell me a little bit about, because we talk about it a lot. Hunting is conservation. Hunters are conservationists. Talk a little bit about that and where you've seen that from, you know, over the past 30 years, how it's come to mean, what it means to you and what everybody else it should mean to them too.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I go there, I got to say, I'm still kind of tickled that you had the Doobie Brothers on at the first segment and then you had me on to into the second segment. Oh, yeah. That's the big time.
Yes, sir.
So I'm walking around here right now. My feet are off the ground and floating around here thinking I'm pretty hot stuff.
You have arrived in the radio industry when you are bumper music.
There you go. That's awesome. That's a feather in my cap. I'm pretty proud of that.
Yes, sir.
But, back to your question. You know, I think, you know, we've had a pretty rough ride over the last, you know, I'd say 40 years. Really kind of, maybe even before that, probably started when Bambi came out in the, you know, the early 60s.
Sure.
The popular press has, the pendulum, you know, kept swinging, and it kept swinging far, far, far away from hunting being a pastime that was respected. And it's, you know, it's really quite sad, and it's a disservice to the wildlife that hunters have work so hard to protect and to manage over, you know, the last 100 years. And I don't know why it happened. You know, what was the catalyst? You know, some people say it was, you know, President Kennedy being assassinated. There was hunting shows on television. Then they, you know, guns kind of became a bad thing. And
right.
It was right around that time. And to be fair, some of the earlier people that represented hunting, you know, Howard Roark and these guys, even Hemingway to a degree, you know, the foot on top of the animal. And,
right.
You know, there was a lot of machismo involved, which unfortunately also, you know, brought in misogyny and chauvinism. I mean, it was, you know, they kind of stereotyped us at that point, and that wasn't really respected, and nor should it have been. I mean, you know, the pendulum had to swing, and it did, but it just went way too far away from us for the last 30 years. We've been struggling, getting beat up in the popular press. And it, you know, that's not what hunters are. You know, that you know, lout that spits on the floor and has no higher sensibilities. I mean, hunters are explorers. We're conservationists, like you say. We love the wild animals that we hunt. And, yeah, it's counterintuitive, but it's true. And you know, we've kind of been losing this battle, so to the point where now, you know, when you tell somebody that you're a hunter and that it's good, it's like cognitive dissonance. They can't compute for them because they've read so many ugly, you know, stereotypes about what hunters are and who we are. So I think, you know, hunters, we all know that in our hearts and in our, you know, efforts, what we've done for conservation. I mean, billions and billions of dollars have come from hunters and fishermen to, you know, sustain the wildlife species of the world, whether it's fish or wildlife, you know, big game animals. We know we've done that, but we're not getting the message out there. So how have I seen it change? Hunters are still doing what they do, but I think we're more aware now of the importance of telling our story and taking that narrative back from the animal rights groups that have been vilifying us and marginalizing us for so many years. So I see in the woods now actually a hunter that's more acquainted with the battle and more responsible, more aware that, you know, their actions are going to speak volumes, especially in this new world of social media.
Yes.
So I'm seeing, I don't want to say they're smarter hunters, but I'd say they're they're more cognizant of their actions and responsibilities towards wildlife and towards the, you know, the public, the non-hunting public out there. So I'm starting to see that pendulum. I think it's stopped.
Okay.
And I think it's actually now about to start swinging back in our favor. And you know, the younger generation, they don't want to buy into a bunch of tubular thinking like their parents, and they want to know the truth. They're so used to, you know, the news nowadays being full of lies.
Sure.
That you know, they just don't swallow it hook, line, and sinker like their parents did. So I'm actually, you know, I think we're going to see a swing back. It would be nice if the darn pendulum would stop swinging so far either side,
right,
and kind of stop in the middle for a little bit, so we can all
catch
our breath
rez.
And yeah, start over again. But anyway, I'm hopeful that the future will bring, you know, a greater awareness of the positive that hunters bring to the wildlife of this world.
It's a message we try to get out. It just doesn't go very far.
Well, it goes to our own, you know, crowd, which
sure,
unfortunately, you know, but I mean, radio programs like yours, you're reaching right now. There's somebody out there that's a non-hunter, you know, and there's more than one. Maybe there's 100. Maybe there's 1,000. You know, I saw the numbers that you have listening to your program, and you know, there's a percentage of them that are non-hunters that are listening
sure,
right now. And hey, maybe I should rethink, you know, not buy into the bunk that I'm reading in the popular press, and actually educate myself on what hunters do, the positive that they're work that they're doing for wildlife.
You know, I don't watch outdoor TV much. When I was a kid growing up, I watched a lot of it because there was only one or two, Kurt Gowdy and some of those guys. But lately, Sling TV had a weekend where they had the outdoor channel on, and I got actually caught several episodes of Uncharted. And when you were talking about hunters and, you know, the message we're trying to get out is, would you say that Uncharted is trying to get that message out by with all the places you're going and showing people that in different parts of the country, hunting means something totally different?
Oh, 100%. I mean, to me, Uncharted allows us to be ambassadors, you know, not only to foreign lands, but also ambassadors, you know, here in North America to, again, people that don't hunt. We get a, you know, I get the emails and the texts and the social media comments and how many people, you know, my wife doesn't hunt, but she loves the Uncharted television show. You know, we're reaching out into the non-hunting public with that show, and that's exactly what it's about, is that message. But, you know, coupled with some probably even more important messages like tolerance. You know, if this world had a little more tolerance, we'd be a better place, and all of us can probably look that word up and just remind ourselves how important it is. So we go to these places like Somalia, Pakistan, Iran, Azerbaijan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan. I mean, you know, we go to these places that, you know, are supposedly filled with people that hate us, and we prove that no, that's not the case. You know, there's good people everywhere around the world, good people that believe in the same things and want the same things that we do.
Sure.
Even if they dress differently and their language is different, their food is different, their religions are different, their governments are obviously different, and oftentimes their governments are bullies and gangsters that are in positions of power because the people can't do anything about it. You know, but the people themselves they're not bad. You know, and this is where the tolerance comes in, and we use wildlife management and the situation with wildlife in those countries as, I guess, the reason to visit there and, you know, then learn about the cultures and the people. So that's the bigger message. Of course, the you know, secondary message is the positive, again, that hunters, you know, work in this world of wildlife, you know, against the warriors who are attacking wildlife. You know, we're there.
Yeah.
Hunters are there right on the front lines.
Wherever you go, we are indeed a brotherhood.
100%, and that's a natural connection that we have. And I don't care if it's kings and queens and paupers, or, you know, someone black, white, purple, green. It doesn't matter. You know, even the languages, it makes no difference. You know, I've been up with the Inuit in the Arctic, and listened to an Inuit lady who was in her 80s, sing a song in Inuit, Inuktuk, the language, and of course I couldn't understand the words, but I will guarantee that every single hunter listening understood the meaning of that song, and as I did, right there, it's brotherhood or brethren. It's a spiritual relationship that every hunter around this planet has with other hunters. Doesn't matter demographics.
One of the folks, if you want to watch a good one, that is truly, and I can probably say this about all your hunts. I've never heard or seen a canned one, but the one you were on some kind of sheep hunt, and you're up in the mountains. It's rocky, and your gun is off. And you shoot several times, and it runs at you. You miss again, and you're just absolutely dumbfounded as to what's going on. And I'm like, that's reality. Sometimes it's good, and sometimes it's bad.
Yep, and we always show it on my shows, Hunting Adventures. The Professionals was another show we did for 4 years. And if it's, good, bad, the ugly, we show it. It's real. I certainly don't put myself up on any kind of pedestal and say, I'm never going to show a miss, because I'm super hunter guy. That's crap. I mean, and if I ever pretend that I am, you come and give me a kick in the rear end.
Oh yeah, right. Okay, mark that one down. Things I'll never do, kick Jim in the butt.
Well, hopefully I'll never deserve it.
Sure.
I'm a hunter just like everybody else listening right now, or most of the listeners, and no different than any. I mean, I grew up in a trailer park, for goodness sake. So believe me, my feet are solid on the ground, and it's not a. I will never ever do disservice to the responsibility and the respect that people have for what I've accomplished.
And that is a very long list of accomplishments. Everybody I talk to knows Jim Shockey and what he has done for hunting and the ambassador he's been, and we sure appreciate it through both your television shows and just the things you do. And in the Hand of Man, the museum you're at. Hang on. We're going to take another break. Come back. We're going to have more with Jim Shockey, and it's all going to be fun. Hang on, folks.
Up, but it ain't pretty. I'll never fit in your big city. I may be feral, but at least bang, 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 bang. I want to be in charge of the boom. Attack my country and face your doom. There won't be any.
Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. That is our guest, Jim Shockey, singing his song, which has now become part of the bumper music for this show. That's pretty good. Attack my country. That's absolutely right. Mr. Shockey, I'm 52 and I'm still going to call you Mr. Shockey because out of respect, which it's just a Southern thing. So don't think it's calling you old or anything. It's just what we do down here.
No, I appreciate it.
And I asked Steve Rinella this question one time and it came off his lips. Just boom, he knew exactly where it was going. So I want to ask you, has there been one time over 30 years of outfitting or maybe before that or maybe with some of the we talked about the stands that you've been to, has there ever been one time in your life where you looked at the situation and go, this is the end of Jim Shockey. It's all coming to an end right here. I'm just not going to survive this one.
I can honestly say that there hasn't been. It's not – I mean, I've been charged by hippos many times, elephants, Cape buffalo. I even had a cougar last year try and kill me, and jumped out of the bush behind me and I had to swing around and shoot. But I can honestly say that in all those situations, I don't even think my heart went up, two or three beats. It's just, and the reason is because if you're going to do that for a living, then, you have to be absolutely confident in your abilities to deal with a situation. I'm kind of giggling as you told me that you asked Steve Rinella that. I'm curious, what did Steve say? Because I saw him, a moose come after him here last year on TV. I was watching his show, and it was a pretty close call for him. But again, from my side, I don't want to sound arrogant, but no. I'm a professional at this. And
sure.
And that means, you know, there's people's lives that are, you know, they're depending on me, my cameraman. I mean, he's the one standing behind me with, you know, what's he going to do, bunk whatever it is on the head with a $40,000 camera? You better not. You know, and if he's bonking on the head, he's not getting the footage like he's supposed to be doing. So, you know, so in those kind of situations, honestly, now, you know, you just deal with it. I mean,
sure.
It's not a fear. And the thing is, you know, so, you know, was there a moment when I thought, you know, it's over for Jim Shockey? Well, and I apologize for talking in third person here.
No.
But it, you know, absolutely not, because, you know, Jim Shockey's job in that moment is to make a good shot and finish the situation up. And that's, you know, get rid of the danger. So there really wasn't any danger. I mean, it's not even a, so why get all excited about it? I mean, afterwards it's kind of exciting because
sure.
you're like, holy cow, did you see that? You know, like you'll see my eyes big as saucers go, did you see that? But honestly, my heart is still going the same rate. It's just like, I'm kind of astounded that, you know, that thing tried to kill me.
Yeah.
I mean, A, what was it thinking? And, you know, B, did you get it on camera? You know, it's, and I guess that's arrogant because, you know, I never really gave the animal not even a, so you're saying there's a chance. I mean,
right.
there just isn't.
Well,
you know, and that's my, so I've never considered those dangerous situations. You know, I've certainly been extremely aware and switched on in many, many situations, you know, hunting with my buddy Mike Fell in Tanzania, and I mean, all around the Africa we've hunted together. You know, there's times when you're in the bush and you can't see 10 yards and you've got a pygmy forest elephant that's really upset because they hate, you know, the pygmies. They shoot them full of arrows all the time.
Right.
You know, so those elephants are going to charge and squish you, and you can't see it, but you know it's there. It knows you're there, and, you know, it's a tense situation, but it's not, you know, it's not any, I never honestly have thought that's a problem. Now, you know, next year you'll probably be having another, you remember Jim Shockey? He said that, and, you know, now he's got grizzly bear spit all over him and claw marks.
Well,
you know, so it can happen, but honestly, if it ever does, I messed up.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't stop early enough. I didn't, you know, I wasn't paying enough attention. I was too overconfident, you know, hubris, whatever it is, it, you know, that's what will be the, if that ever happens from an animal, you know, there's been all those crazy countries. I mean, Somalia,
yes.
we were hunting there for a month, and we had, you know, I had to use a subsonic round just so the sound of the, you know, the rifle fire wouldn't carry so that the bad guys wouldn't hear us. I mean, that kind of thing is, you know, I suppose it's, dangerous, but not really. I mean, I don't know. It's not like I'm a soft target.
Right.
You know, Pakistan, right on the border with Afghanistan, you know, I mean, that's, you know, that was probably a situation where you're, you know, and you've got one vehicle behind us with a rocket launcher on it, one in front with a 50 cal machine gun mounted on it, and about 10 heavily armed, you know, Pakistani mercenaries. I mean, that's pretty serious, but again, you know, who would attack that convoy?
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully there's no drone above that doesn't recognize it's me.
They see the red bandana.
Yeah, there you go, and the cowboy hat. Actually, there ain't no cowboy hat when I'm in those countries. I'm actually dressed up like a Pashtun warrior, and surprisingly, I kind of look like one a little bit. It's strange.
You would.
Yeah, once I grow a beard, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
But no, I haven't been. You know, airplanes are probably the most dangerous part of what I do. Vehicles in those countries, you know, you're up in the middle of nowhere on roads that are, you know, switching back 6,000 or 7,000 feet, and you know, horrible roads, and
right.
Not everybody is a good driver there. So, and the vehicles are definitely garbage. So you're, you know, brakes go, whatever. That's, but again, I've never really felt like it's, you know, that I've, you know, it's the end of me.
Okay.
Now, if I'm, you know, that said, if I forget to get milk today when I go home,
yeah, it might be the end of
you. And Nana Weezy's waiting for me, that could be the end of me. So, So it'll probably be more like that. I didn't listen to Nana Weezy on something.
I hear you. But, interesting enough, Steve's answer was they killed a moose, and they had to come out at night, and the next day when they went back in, they came in downwind of the kill site and spooked two bears that were on the kill, and the bears
were
exactly where they were. And Steve said one of them went right by him, almost knocked him down, and hit his and ran into his photographer. And the bear and the photographer were rolling down the hill, and the whole bunch of them thought the bear was attacking the photographer. He said they got to the bottom of the hill, and the bear kept going. He was just as scared as anybody else. He said that's the only time. He said, but that was really Evan. I thought that was, you know, that was it. And it was just one of those situations beyond your control.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it's kind of an objective danger. On the other hand, you know, let's face it, you're walking into a dead moose in bear country.
That's it.
So it's, I mean, I don't know, the bear should have been dead before it got to his cameraman. But I'm not judging Steve. I wasn't there. But
I don't think any of them knew that bear was there until it came and ran.
What I want to know is, did the cameraman continue to work for him? Because I know if I let my guys get mauled by a bear or run over by a bear, that they would be PO'd at me. And they would probably they'd stop working for me right then.
I don't know. I have to ask him that next time. Is your cameraman still working for you? let's see. Wow, we got about 3 minutes left. In 2 or 3 minutes, can you tell us your favorite place to be in the outdoors?
You know, I've been around the world, obviously, a bunch of different times, top to bottom, side to side, and there's some really magnificent places in this world. Now, you know, speaking geographically, because if you speak more symbolically, I'd like to be, you know, beside Eva,
sure.
You know, my son,
sure.
You know, Louise, anything to do with family. But if you're talking geographically, absolutely, you know, the Yukon. Up in our Rogue River Alpine territory in the Yukon, it's about 7.5 million acres, and there's not a single road, not a single house, just our cabins, our tent camps. And it's such pure remote wilderness. There's nothing like it in the world left anymore. The Arctic has, you know, maybe Antarctica or I guess possibly the Arctic, but there's, you know, the Inuit are up there. Siberia is like Grand Central Station compared to the Yukon. There's so few people live there. I mean, 35,000 people in the entire, you know, Yukon territories, and most of those live in Whitehorse. So there just isn't any people. And it's like walking back in time, you know, just post last ice age. And there's a one little knob that's at the sort of head of a valley that I have my particular camp in. If you've watched our shows, you'll know the camp. That if you sit there at the last couple of days in September or August and the first week of September, when basically the Yukon goes from summer to winter, it is, I think, the most unbelievably beautiful, spiritually pure place that I've ever been. And I truly love, you know, the Yukon, but that particular spot, every year I make the pilgrimage to sit on that knob and look up and down, you know, 60 miles each way and 3 miles across a flat valley, and all the, you know, the mountain birch are changing to a crimson red at that time. The willow runs are yellow. It's beautiful.
Sitting here thinking about, what would it take for me to get there? Sounds like a place I need to go. Well, hang on, Jim. We're going to wrap up this segment, and we'll be back with the final segment of Woods and Water South Conference another Saturday. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. We have had had a fun day here so far, Mr. Jim Shockey, and I do appreciate him taking his time all the way from his home, which is in Pacific time, folks. And, but yeah, appreciate him doing this for us. Jim, we're in the last segment. I do want to get to the Jim Shockey Classic, which is going to be held here at Myrtle at Wild Dunes in March? April.
March. 22nd and 23rd,
right.
Yeah.
But I would like to get...
Charleston.
Charleston. Wild Dunes in Charleston. That's right. Oh, man. I always hate coming up with questions because I think they're all good, and I don't know which one to ask. Trophy hunting. It goes back to what we discussed in the first segment about hunting in general, the pendulum swinging and public perception. You know, the latest report to NSF that came out, you know, 80% of the non-hunting public support hunters who are, you know, they're hunting to fill the freezer, so to speak. You know, it's their pursuit, it's their adventure, and people understand that and get that. You put the word trophy in front of hunting, and that support drops to somewhere around 20%. And I know you have an opinion on this because I read it, but I'd like for you to tell everybody else. Where are we going wrong with trophy hunting today?
Well, I mean, the term has been hijacked, and you know, it's they are implying by that the negative side of, you know, trophy is that a hunter, which, you know, isn't a hunter as we know it, goes and kills an animal, cuts off its head, and, you know, leaves the animal to rot, and the animal, you know, takes the head of the animal and sticks it on his wall.
Right.
So there is what trophy hunting by definition has become in our popular press. I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. If anybody, I mean, where you live, if you go kill an animal, cut its antlers off if it's a deer and leave the body to rot, what happens to you?
Game warden shows up at your house.
Exactly. You get charged. You get charged. And
long
it's a
ways.
Serious,
yes.
Yeah, serious offense. It's called poaching. And this is what, the, you know, they've hijacked this term trophy hunting and you know, started to apply it to hunters when, in fact, it's what they really mean is poaching. So the problem is that 80% that you're talking about, of course, you know, there's a percentage of them that, you know, their tubular vision doesn't allow them to see anything outside of their own ideologies. They're going to be animal rights. You know, they hate hunters, period. And that's fair enough. 10% of the population hates hunting and hunters, and 10% of the population loves hunting and hunters. That's always been the same. It's never going to change. So of that 80% that are against trophy hunting, of course, there's a percentage of them are just against hunting, period.
Okay.
The rest of them are not being asked the right question. You know, what, you know, ask them to define what they think trophy hunting is, and they'll say, and a guy that goes and hunts just for the meat or just for the antlers or horns, you know, cuts those off and leaves the rest to rot. That's how they'll answer it. So when you explain to them, oh, no, that's actually poaching. So, you know, what you're really, you know, the if you properly spin it instead of improperly, is you've got 80% of the people out there are against poaching. You know, and that's what they're actually against. Now, if you said to them, you just flip that question slightly and saying, are you against, you know, selective hunting where, you know, the oldest animals beyond breeding age are taken out of the population, which generally is a good thing for the rest of the population of that wild game species and good for the habitat, good for the ecosystem. Are you for or against that? You know, I would dare say that the vast majority would be for it, just like the vast majority would be for hunting for meat. Now, when you explain to them that, hey, listen, if a hunter takes the meat of the animal, fills his freezer, feeds his family, feeds his friends, and also takes the antlers, you know, and you know, because that's part of the tradition of hunting as a memory,
right,
which is actually the definition of what trophy is, a memory of an accomplishment or an event. Again, you would have the vast majority saying, yeah, we don't have a problem with that if you, you know, take the meat and utilize the meat. So suddenly the question was an improper question, and it's abused in the press constantly. You know, 80% are against trophy hunting. No, they're against poaching. You know, 80% is against trophy hunting. No, you know, they don't understand that trophy hunters are selective hunters. And I would argue, you know, there's the meat side of things. You hunt for meat. Well, we all hunt for meat. You know, I'm looking at a wall right now with, I don't know, a dozen antlers, moose antlers.
Okay.
And every one of those moose was eaten. I mean, when I grew up, if my father didn't get a moose, every fall. We didn't eat meat all winter. We didn't go buy a cow. I didn't even know you could buy a cow until I got to high school. You know, like I said, I grew up in a trailer park. So moose was a very important part of our diet. And yet my father, who was an avowed meat hunter, you know, pure meat hunter, he would always take the antlers of the moose if it was a decent moose. I mean, you know, he'd always bring those homes. And I'd love to hold them and see them. In fact, I dragged them to school for show and tell when I was grade 3, one set of my dad's moose antlers. He took the meat. Of course, that's what we wanted and that's what we lived on, but he also took the antlers. And that's what trophy hunters do. You know, and I think it's, you know, we have to be very careful. Even, I don't mean to preach here, but I'm going to. We have to be careful within our own ranks that we don't say, I only hunt for meat, and I would never hunt anything other than for meat. Because that argument might get you, get you by at a cocktail party where they're, you know, I don't like hunters, and the conversation rolls around you being a hunter, and you say, I only hunt for meat. You know, great. But what you've done by that is thrown all the other hunters under the bus that hunt. I mean, you're telling me you're driving all the way to Colorado to get an elk. I mean, do the numbers. Does it really work out on a per pound basis? Mm-hmm. Especially if, you know, you go 3 times and don't get one.
Don't ask my wife that question.
No, and you're going all the way down to, you know, you're driving down, or going, flying down to Mexico to go after coos deer, and you're only hunting for meat? Give me a break. It's not true. And so it's disingenuous for us to go down that road when we're at a cocktail party. And I use that figuratively. I'm talking about any time we're, you know, out in the public, we're being accosted about being hunters or even being questioned on it. That, you know, that's a very important part of all hunting. And a very important part of what all hunters do is utilize the meat. And because you go to Africa and you hunt plains game and you shoot 6 antelope and you're not bringing the meat home, doesn't mean that the meat is not utilized. In fact, I would argue that there's more meat utilized on those antelope over in Africa than there is on the deer over here. Now there's exceptions, but there's nothing left. I mean, the rumen is taken, everything's taken. There's what's left is a tiny little pile of green stuff that's inside the stomach, and even that they take part of. So it's, you know, so does that make that hunter evil? Does it make him wrong? Does it make him, you know, that quote unquote trophy hunter because he's not hunting for meat? No, he's still hunting for meat. The meat's utilized by the people in the village, the tribal people in that area. And also a rancher. So a rancher, he should only raise one cow a year because it's for his family. So, you know, well, they say, well, of course not. He's a rancher. Well, guess what? There's hunters that hunt more than what they eat for themselves and their family. But the meat is still utilized, and there's nothing wrong with that. And the dollars that they're spending to hunt those animals is being used to protect that species or protect the wildlife in that area, the entire ecosystem. You know, if they don't, then if they don't make that effort to go all the way to Africa to hunt those animals, that land will be turned back into cattle range, goat range, sheep range, whatever, domestic animals. And it's not like we don't have enough of those animals in the world already. You know, there's 7 billion cows in this world. You know, they tie us. There's 25 billion chickens. You know, they're the best competitors in terms of survival of any animal on this planet. You know, there are 6 billion horses or 3 billion horses, 6 billion goats, 6 billion sheep. We don't need more. We need more habitat for wildlife, and hunting does that. And pure meat hunting doesn't do that. Right. Now, these guys that go over there and hunt over there, yeah, they're, you know, I guess by definition, they're, you know, they're not hunting for meat like someone who goes out in their back 40 and kills only a deer, period, and only kills what they eat. You know, but it doesn't, you know, again, it doesn't address what about the predators? What about coyotes that are, you know, killing the deer fawns, which they do.
Oh, yes.
You know, significant impact.
Yes, sir.
You know, but someone tells me I only kill what I eat. Well, great. You're really contributing to helping the wildlife that you're hunting to eat by not killing a coyote because you don't eat it. We have to be very careful on that argument. It might get us by on a cocktail party and a fancy party in Hollywood or New York City or wherever we're hanging out if we're in those places. But it really what we need to be doing is saying, well, here's the truth about what you think is trophy hunting and all the meat is utilized by all hunters. We can't divide, into groups and point fingers. Well, he baits, so I don't bait, so I'm better. You know, he uses dogs, I'm better. I don't hunt predators. I would never hunt a cougar because I don't eat it, which is really, truly one of the greatest big game meat animals in North America. You know, so again, we just have to be careful that we're not, pointing fingers and then letting those, smaller groups within the hunting community get cut out and ostracized so that someday, when they come for us, we look around, there's nobody there help us.
That's right.
Nobody there, just you. So we have to be careful that the whole meat and trophy thing that we fight every single time someone tries to tell us that, those trophy hunters are bad, then we have to stand up and say, wait a minute, here's the reality. We have to fight. And that's a hill we have to die on.
That's right.
Unfortunately, one that we can, and anyone that says, I only eat meat, I only eat what I kill. We have to be very, very careful on that, because I don't think long term that argument is going to actually be sustainable. Because you can't tell me it's when it costs you $1,000 a pound for an animal that's what we're doing. Yeah. I mean, give me a break,
right.
And that, again, that argument is going to be shown to be fallacious at some point. I don't even know if fallacious is a word, but it sure sounds like one. It sounds like a word that we don't want to happen to hunters. So.
That's right. Well, we're at the end. I hate that because the Jim Shockey Classic, but I think we're going to work on something of that outside this show. Mr. Jim Shockey, thank you for taking your time today to be on the show. I think everybody listening, I would venture to say, has a lot to think about. But I really appreciate it. Folks, as always, take time to get out there. Make time. Not going to pass. Take the back roads when you can. Don't forget the camera. Back next week for more Woods and Water, South Carolina.